talk about advanced theory. I figure this is the easiest way to do it. I've done this lecture too many times. And what I did was took all of, I think, terminology associated with arguments that have been popular and defined them. And we're going to go through the definitions, and then after we go through the definitions, you tell me what you want to talk about. You know, because I have a pretty good collection theory, so we're all set. Let's talk about the present. What's going on now? Number one, topical counterplans. Now, a topical counterplan is a counterplan that competes with the affirmative plan. It would be topical, but for the affirmative interpretation. In other words, if the affirmative defines the resolution as their plan, that is the resolution for the rest of the debate. Had they not done that, all the remainder of the resolution was potential topical affirmative land. Right? So anything in resolution world, I don't want to make it sound geopolitical, but anything in there would be a possibility for a topical counterplan. So it's topical because it also comes from resolution, even though it's not the affirmative. Permutations of replanning. Permutations. Major permutations include the simultaneous action, do the plan and the counterplan at the same time. Time frame firm that says do the plan first, followed by the counterplan. That tends to be preferred. The judges have some problem doing the counterplan first because they think that's not topical. I'm not sure that's true, but the time frame firm tends to work better when the plan comes first. The third one is exclusion permutation. The exclusion permutation says do the counterplan but for the plan. So if someone wants socialism, do socialism everywhere but for the plan. All right? Cool. Permutations are tests. As tests, they are logical games, and they don't become part of the plan. In replanning, the permutation becomes the plan. It is incorporated into the plan as plank four. Right? It becomes part of the plan. So what happens is the affirmative advocates the permutation. Replanning is not as popular as it has been in the past. Most people think it's extra topical to put a plan plank into your plan, which you know, is action other than the resolution. The response has generally been, this is normal means. Right? The normal means of the process would include this, just like you include enforcement and all this other crap. Three, conditional counterplans. A conditional counterplan is a counterplan that the negative can drop in the debate at will. Right? For any reason at all. So, I'm tired of this guy. That's conditional. It's usually conditional on how good the other team is, truthfully. Right? We're going to run this counterplan. If they don't answer it properly, we'll keep it. If they do answer it properly, it'll go away. You know? And people tend to reject conditional counterplans because they claim it violates the advocacy requirement of debate. Like, you have to advocate positions. Right? You just don't get to suggest it. Four, plan-inclusive counterplans. I do these a lot. I love them. I've been doing them for years. These are counterplans where you adopt the affirmative but for an exclusion. The reason you do this is because what you want to do is take the debate into your world. Like if we're debating Northwestern, we don't want to play their game, you know? It's going to be a pain in the ass getting in that debate. So what we'll do instead is we'll do Northwestern's affirmative and exclude. Last year we liked to exclude Native Hawaiians, for example. That was our favorite one. UMKC liked to exclude Puerto Rico. Right? Traditionally, you've excluded groups. On your topic, you'll probably exclude sanction categories. That'll be the big one. Right? You'll find a sanction that the affirmative is releasing that you want to keep. And so what you're doing is the whole debate changes. You're no longer debating the affirmative, you're debating the exclusion category. A lot of stuff on eDebate on this. Check the archives on eDebate. It's very good. The PIC debate that took place was very good. That's what a PIC is, the plan inclusive counterplan. The lay counterplan. We like these two. They're a lot of fun. This is where you do the affirmative later. Like the action of the present is not to do the affirmative, you do it later. And you do it after, usually, an election, or after a treaty is signed or negotiated, or after some important legislation is resolved. I think what's going to happen, I mean, I know I'm going to write a version of this for Carolina at least. I think what's going to happen is we're going to run a position that says there's important legislation in the pipeline, Clinton needs to focus on this important legislation in order to guarantee like the amendments are quashed or the legislation gets true. So you shouldn't screw around the affirmative until after this takes place. So we're going to delay the affirmative until this legislation is resolved, then we'll do the affirmative. Right? That's how the delay counterplan would work. Dispositional counterplan, you've heard this word. A dispositional counterplan is very interesting. It's a counterplan which is jettisoned should the affirmative permute the counterplan. Right? If you run a counterplan and the affirmative gets up and goes, perm, a lot of perm, you grant the perms and the counterplan goes away. That's a dispositional counterplan. Now if they get up there and go, perm, lot, perm, lot, then they go, counterplan is bad, disset one, disset two, disset three. You grant the perms and the disset go away with the counterplan. They all go away. But if you're in a round and you run your counterplan and somebody stands up and goes, disset one, disset two, disset three, your counterplan, and does not say the word perm, you're stuck with it. Right? It's disposed of via the permutation. Narratives and tropes. People like to tell stories in debate now, and narrative is a way of doing it. Let me tell you, there's three types of narratives that are out there. The first type of narrative is written by the resolution. For example, if you have a legal topic, there's all that literature that says the stories that people tell their lawyers are the important things, not the stories the lawyers tell the judges. Right? That's what it's about. That what happens when the lawyer defines the story told by the plaintiff's voice is silenced. That's how that works. Right. That also is in the area of human rights. It's really excellent human rights literature that says the complaints told the human rights advocates are what's important, not what the human rights advocates tell the investigators. On the education topic, I just said, it's the story the kids are saying, are telling, not the stories that the educational theorists are telling. Right? And you could probably work that into this debate resolution, claiming that the important stories are the stories being told by the people on the streets, in Baghdad. What's happening there? That's what needs to be examined. Or what's happening in Havana? Or what's happening in Pyongyang? That's where it's important. That's where the voices need to be. We need to hear their voices, because their voices are always silenced. That's the whole basis for the Said book on Orientalism. That's what he's talking about. When Said wrote the book on Orientalism back in the 50s, I think, when he was at Columbia, he said that what happened is the way we looked at Islam, the way we looked at Islam was a way where their voices were silenced. Because we looked at them as if they were oriental, right? They were completely different. And being completely different, we couldn't understand what they were saying, so they became other. So what's going to happen in these debates is people will run narratives that are contextual to the resolution. The second type of narrative that they can run is a proof narrative, where what they're going to do is instead of reading evidence we traditionally read in a debate, they will read testimony or an anecdote by a person describing an experience that occurred while visiting this country, while living in this country, etc., and use that as proof. So it's anecdote as proof, right? A story as proof. The third category is the personal narrative, which is rather difficult to do. I think there are some people probably in the audience who could do you could probably put together a Cuban American narrative probably pretty well than some of the Miami folk, right? But a lot of us are so alien to this debate topic, right? This is so different from us, we'd have a hard time doing it. But I would expect narratives to come out that would also be personal. Tropes. Tropes are things we use to tell stories. A metaphor is a trope. So is a simile is a trope. All that imagery stuff is trope, right? One of the tropes that people use is irony. And irony is becoming a little more popular in terms of position. I know John likes to run it at Claremont McKenna, and we've debated it once or twice. The irony debate is where the affirmative stands up and makes an ironic proof, which means they deliver a speech that probably should be delivered by a negative debater. In other words, they will say things like, the world could not be a better place. Look how wonderful it is in this world. We're all eating well, you know, we've got all these cars. The United States couldn't be better. We're as strong as we could be. And what they're actually saying is, you know, we suck. Right, that's how irony works, right? What they're going to do is make a case, and the case is made in such a way that you're led to the conclusion that the opposite is probably true. And I think we'll end up going back here because I can give you some strategies on the negative. Let's talk about the path. Let's turn it over. Alternative justification. This is where you offer multiple plans. You stand up and you offer a plan and you have an advantage. You run another plan, you have another advantage. You run another plan, you have another advantage. You run another plan, you have another advantage. Yada, yada, yada. That's how it works. Right? You could do the country game, I think. I think you could stand up and do one plan for each country and one advantage for each country. The way alternative justification works is all you have to do is prove the resolution is probably true. You can do that with one example, so you jettison the rest towards the end of the debate. So it's a shell game, right? That's exactly what it is. That's how it's designed. It's designed to attract arguments. It forces the negative to be incredibly strategic because their linked stories have to apply to each of the plans and they have to have something on each of the cases in order to be effective on the negative. A variation of this is the one that we ran, which was kind of fun when I was debating, which is, because we AJ'd every debate we're in. But the one we used to run is we used to have one advantage and four plans, which is kind of fun. Because the advantage is peace and happiness in the world, right? I could think of a lot of ways of getting there. So we'd run four plans, say, here are four ways of doing it. And when people said, that's illegitimate, that's abusive, we go, no, that's exactly what happens in Congress. When a congressional committee gets together and says, we need to solve this problem, what the hell do? They look at a bunch of plans. Right? They examine one plan versus another plan versus another plan. We just have to have one that works at the end. And we always claimed it wasn't that abusive because it's just one advantage. Right? It's just one advantage. Granted, it would retake the world, but, you know, and we outweigh all your dissents, but none. Intrinsicness. People hate this argument. They just hate this argument. And I think they hate this argument because they can't answer it. They just go, whoa, this is bad. Evil. It should go lower on the list, right? Intrinsicness is an argument about causality. It says that the causality relationship that's found in the disadvantage, or the causality relationship that's found in the advantages of the counterplan, or the causality relationships that are found in the advantages of the affirmative case, are illegitimate. The argument is that they are unrealistic. Example, if you're running the Clinton dissad and the impact of the Clinton dissad is India-Pakistani pro-lift, right, that's going to be your impact story. What would happen is the affirmative will respond that goes, that doesn't make any sense. The present system would step in and prevent India-Pakistani conflict. They would do the affirmative and provide things like hotline between India and Pakistan or permissive action links for their nuclear weapons. Or we would provide, it's called asymmetric transparency, where one country lets the other country know what they have, even though the other country doesn't want to let them know what they have. We would do these things. And of course people go, these are nasty. And you go, well, you know, what they are is how the system works. Because what they are a bunch of hypothetical counterplans, right? The present system could do all the things. The thing that's weird on intrinsicness arguments is you don't really advocate them. It's not like they become part of your advocacy. You're just describing how the present system will resolve the problem. And most people complain that the targets then move a lot, and that's bad because it's bad to have moving targets. Now we get to the evil. Plan. I've judged it. I've never voted for it. And I'm pretty liberal. I mean, I'll vote for anything. You know, and I've watched some damn good debaters debate plan, you know. And, you know, I think the negative generally does a better job than the affirmative on this. The argument is that the focus of debate should be on who is making the best resolutional proof, whether the affirmative or the negative. They claim, the advocates of plan, that right, traditionally it was plan versus counterplan. And the way we evaluate plan versus counterplan is looking at competition, right? They claim, the advocates of plan, that competition is incredibly difficult to establish. It's all rhetorical. It has no meaning. It's difficult to do. They say the better way to compare would be to compare versus the quality of the argument. So what happens in a plan debate is the first affirmative constructive is plan and advantage, and the first negative constructive is a different plan and a different advantage, both of which are topical. And the way you decide which team wins is either, I have to say this because I'm not quite sure, because the other USC ran it a different way than Pace. But when USC ran it, Southern Cal ran it, their argument was, I should decide which team to vote for based upon who had the better interpretation of topicality. In other words, which team had the better topical proof? Which was, I bet, more central to the resolution? That was the USC answer. The Pace answer was different. The Pace answer was, I should evaluate the quality of the arguments themselves. Like, I would look at the affirmative that the 1AC ran, and I would look at the affirmative that the 1NC ran, and I'd see which one has the better internal link stories and scenarios, and that's what I would go for. So it really has been resolved. The problem with plan has been, in order for plan to work, you really have to change your perspective of what you're doing in debate. Because you're no longer focusing on the plan, you're focusing on the probable truth of the resolution. Which, by the way, was what got us into the whole resolution, hasty generalization, counter-warrant, and Broglie in the first place. That's how it all happened. It all happened because that back then people were going, well, yeah, you have to focus on the resolution. So the downside of plan is it does open the gate to that part of the debate world again. Counterplans. When someone runs a counterplan and it competes with the affirmative plan, they sometimes have advantages in the counterplan that have nothing to do with the competition. A classic example is this, is the socialism counterplan. Right? Because what part of the plan competes with the counterplan is the part of the plan which does stuff that is violates the socialist spirit. Right? The mechanism of the plan that does that. Now, of course, with the negative runs of socialism counterplan, their first advantage is we solve the problem. Their second advantage is we have world peace, right? Because socialism is wonderful. Well, the world peace part of the socialism counterplan is extra competitive, right? It doesn't derive directly from the competitive element of the counterplan. It derives from the thesis about socialism. Those extra competitive advantages need to go away because they outweigh your affirmative, right? You want to get rid of them. And one of the ways to do this was derived from works by Bob Branham originally, and then Korsak stole it from Bob Branham and suggested instead that what we need to do is argue opportunity cost. And here's how it works. If I'm the first affirmative and I do my affirmative planning case, and then the first negative constructive gets up there and runs the socialism counterplan with an extra competitive advantage at the bottom that says socialism saves the world, then what the second affirmative constructive does is run a counter-counterplan. The second affirmative says the counterplan of socialism competes with the counterplan of anarchy. In other words, there's an opportunity cost. When I go for socialism, I can't go for anarchy. Now, if the advantages to anarchy are grander than the advantages to socialism, that is a reason to reject the socialism counterplan, because its opportunity cost is to keep us from going to anarchy, which is better. Now, the affirmative doesn't do the plan and the counter-counterplan. It uses the counter-counterplan just like the second affirmative uses the permutation. It says the counter-counterplan proves to you to reject the counterplan. I'm not going to advocate it. Just like the second affirmative says, the permutation proves to you you want to reject the counterplan of the first negative. I'm not going to advocate it. It's the same thing. It's brand new. It's not really got its legs yet, but it'll start appearing, especially if people are running broad, systemic counterplans to this debate topic, which I don't doubt. I think people will go into some of the big systemic counterplans, especially because a lot of the critiques on this topic work better as counterplans. They really do. I mean, if I want to have feminist international relations, you've read it already, right? It works better as an affirmative than as a critique. Well, it could also work better as a counterplan than as a critique. That is also through threat perception and realism and orientalism and post-colonialism and all the other isms. They tend to work better as counterplans, but you do the critique on the negative. Well, whenever you do a critique on the negative, you have all these advantages that really don't compete with the plan. Those are the extra competitive advantages. And one of the ways to do that is go, the critique they're arguing in one end as a counterplan will compete with another possible critique. That's the counter-counterplan. And if that other possible critique is better, that proves or rejects their counterplan. I know it's tough, but this is pretty advanced stuff. Next. This is my favorite because I made it. We're getting there. Hold on a minute. Let me go to the last two. The A-resolutional plan. The A-resolutional plan is kind of funny because it's a plan which isn't topical, but should be, because it's important. That's how they are. We ran it last year. We ran Tay-Sachs. And Carolina ran Tay-Sachs at the year. Tay-Sachs was a plan that said we should have Title VII protection so Jews aren't exploited by being forced to take a test which would reveal whether they are carrying the Tay-Sachs gene or not. And people would get up there and go, why is that race and why is that gender? Or, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And we go, well, it should be race, because that's the way we've treated them for the last 4 or 5 decades. That's the basis for the final solution. This needs to be introduced into the debate. We've treated them like a race throughout history. We need to deal with it, and this is a good way to deal with it. We want a crap load of debates with that affirmative, you know? But you really can't just run something that's not topical. You better run something that's not topical with a heart to it, right? I mean, there has to be a good reason to do it. And we just had a bunch of kids who got into the, really wanted to investigate the entire final solution and anti-Semitism in the United States. 13 is brand new. Ran it twice. We ran a lot of weird crap in Carolina, but that's what you get when you hire me. I think you could run on this topic. This is the kind of plan where you have provisions in it. You say you do the affirmative after the affirmative has done the following 3 or 4 things, right? So what you do is you say, we'll do the affirmative plan only after the country that benefits from it does the following 2 or 3 things, right? And the 2 or 3 things they're going to do are the things which avoid the dis-ed, right? You can think through this. It's not too tough. It just says that eliminating the sanctions all at once and going for constructive engagement is probably not a smart thing to do. The smarter thing to do would be to step down out of the sanctions and step into constructive engagement through a series of steps that are specified in the counterplan. And those series of steps will be expressed in the debate by an examination of things like shunning or an examination of some of the dis-eds that are associated with the topic. Right? So you don't do the affirmative immediately, you do it later, and you do it, it's like a delayed counterplan actually, but you do it after a bunch of steps have been done. Alright, the next thing I want to do is tell you, my 1994 book is still in print, it's on Amazon.com, you can get it, Non-Policy Debate. And my year 2000 book will be out in January, and it's called Actual Debating, and it'll also be available through Amazon.com, and you can get it there. And I'm starting a graduate program at Carolina. We got it approved. We're doing it. This is the first year we're doing it, and we're going to be teaching debate coaches. That's what I'm doing. So when you graduate and you want to become a debate coach, come to Carolina. We'll give you graduate assistantships. We'll make you work real hard, and we'll teach you stuff, and you can get an MA. And if you're in two-year institutions, you want to come to Carolina when you're done, come talk to me. I've got lots of scholarships. Okay, I'm done. Let's talk about these. Where do you want to go?